It's the 7th of June, 2025. Feels like it's a while since I've given a formal talk here by Agiri, because we had the Kruba Ajahn visit and felt that was a great success. And then, of course, I stuck with them and followed them to Boston and out to New Hampshire, Temple Forest Monastery, which was their 10th anniversary. So Temple Forest Monastery was founded in 2015. And that was probably the main event of the, you know, the whole thing, the biggest gathering. It's like 300 to 400 people. They said it was bigger than any of their katinas, actually. And so I celebrated that. And then on to up to Toronto and driving out to Perth, Ontario for Tisarana Monastery, Lompoar Viridamo. And we're there for 5-6 days. And on the 2nd of June, we took the Ajahns, the Lompoas, back to Toronto. So Lompoa Liam, Lompoa Dundee, Ajahn Sewang, Ajahn Sek, Ajahn Moshe. Took them in the evening, so saw them off at the airport at about, it was about 11:30 p.m. when we parted ways, because they were boarding a flight at 1 a.m. on June 3rd. Eva Air back to Taipei, then Bangkok. And then went to, I accompanied Lompoar Viridamo to an airport hotel nearby. Got a couple hours of sleep. Driver took me, well, actually, we took the train, the little tram, back to the terminal, and then I boarded my flight 6:30 a.m. June 3rd, Toronto time, which was 3:30 a.m. here, back to San Francisco, and then somebody offered a meal, and I had a little bit of rest, and then went to Berkeley Buddhist Monastery to teach the first Tuesday program there, the 5 p.m. tea time, followed by the 7:30 p.m. evening program. Then left there about 9:30 p.m., about 10:15 or so, got back to our house where we were staying. So that was a very long day. Then back up here. Now it's the 7th. So a little bit of downtime. We will have more Kruba Ajahns. We plan to have another visit on two more Kruba Ajahns, Lompoar Khu and Lompoar Damrong, arriving on June 21st, pending their visas. So these are always not sure. It's very uncertain whether visas will be issued, but if all goes according to plan, then around the summer solstice, we'll have another visit, which will just be a West Coast visit. So maybe little jaunts out from a Bayagiri, but using a Bayagiri as the base. And that'll be between 2 and 3 weeks. So I am looking forward to that. And I'm also enjoying just having this little bit of downtime and digesting some of the teachings of Lompoa Liam and Lompoa Jundi as well. And just some of the memories and the times, the experiences we had together, traveling together. And just some of the deep wisdom from Lompoa Liam, and say at Tisarana, Lompoa Viridamo was having me introduce the Ajahns and just talk about them, who they are each day, because there were some big gatherings each day, different people, different groups coming for the mealtime. And we got quite a good hit of Lompoa Liam's teachings at Tisarana, because we got to have him, we invited him before the meal blessing each day to give a talk. And so he was giving short Dhamma talks really every day, and then Lompoa Jundi actually meeting with the lay people after the meal, just like he was here. So people getting a good big dose of the deeper Dhamma. And some of the highlights of Lompoa Liam's teachings, some things that struck me. Well, one is, you know, people would ask, who is Lompoa Liam? So at Temple Forest Monastery or at Tisarana or even here, people would ask, well, who is this monk? Who is this bhikkhu? And that's not a very easy question to answer. It's just, and I would just normally answer according to my own feelings, my own views, and say, well, this disciple of Ajahn Chah, considered to be Ajahn Chah's Dhamma heir, and so on, monk for 63 years. But I remember finding myself saying, I think Lungpa Liem is just, he's just the best monk in the world. That's who he is. And people say, well, why is that? Because you see somebody like that who is very, very aloof, very equanimous, maybe, you know, not really making eye contact with people so much, if at all. He's kind of looking around and looking at his hands. And I think, well, you know, oh, that's maybe that's a little bit unusual. But then he's incredibly observant. So some of the observations he'll make are so astute and he'll kind of shock you sometimes. So just the subtlety, the refinement of the of his mindfulness, it's just a exemplar of someone who has the ultimate level of mindfulness, the supreme level of mindfulness and wisdom, and what that looks like. And even at Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, as I was digesting some of these teachings, reflecting on some of these teachings from Lungpa Liem, one person asked during the tea time Q&A, you know, what is, you know, when the mind doesn't create, I was reflecting on this teaching of the difference between the worldly mind and the liberated mind, i.e. the mind that still creates kamma and the mind that no longer creates kamma. And one person at Berkeley asked, well, what does that look like? How does that manifest? How does that play out? And I said, well, it looks like Lungpa Liem. That's what it looks like. That's how it manifests. That's what non-suffering looks like. That's how it plays out. So, but it takes time to really learn about this, and you really have to spend a fair amount of time with somebody like that to really start to see the characteristics of it. So some of the observations that he was making, so when he was here at Abhayagiri one evening over at Santivihara, he said, so he was last here in 2018, so 7 years ago, he said, why is there less traffic on Tomkai Road now? I said, oh, there is less traffic. That's correct, Lungpa. he remembered that. He said, why is there less traffic on the road now? I said, well, you know, the fires happened in 2017. People moved away, and I was trying to think of what could some of the other reasons. Oh, yeah, the marijuana got legalized. People moved away. Wasn't so lucrative anymore. The fields in this area weren't so useful for that maybe anymore. But yeah, he noticed that. And I was also remembering another observation he made here. I think it was back in 2015 when he was here. And he said something like, oh, I can smell the ocean. And a lot of us are thinking, no, Lungpa just doesn't know. He doesn't know that we're not that close to the ocean. He doesn't know that, you know, how far we are from the ocean. He must just be, you know, imagining something. But then I remember learning later that this particular zone where Abhayagiri is, it's the coastal transition zone. So actually, we're on the very edge of the coastal influence, and the coastal air actually does make it here. And he detected it. That's the subtlety of the mindfulness. So, and of course, just seeing an example like that, then we don't really need to hear the teachings, and maybe people didn't even need translated teachings, because just we can learn so much just by being around somebody who's like that. But yeah, some of the details of his teachings, one really stood out to me, which I've kind of been reflecting on, contemplating on, speaking about quite a bit, is the difference between the worldly mind that creates kamma and then the liberated mind that no longer creates kamma. So we see this in the suttas, and on a academic level, we could say, oh yeah, in the suttas it says there is the mind that creates kamma, there's the mind that no longer creates kamma. And there's also, say, bad kamma with bad results, good kamma with good results, mixed kamma with mixed results, and then there's the what we call the imperturbable kamma, or the kamma leading to the ending of kamma, and that's the Noble Eightfold Path. And so, but just Lungpa kind of riffing on this teaching, and when the mind is still enmeshed in the world, so us ordinary folk, you know, most people in the world, when the mind is still enmeshed in the world, still obsessed with its likes and dislikes, and it's still following its preferences, and is still swept up with, say, attraction and aversion, then what happens is the mind is always creating aims. It's creating targets. It's always creating targets and aims. And it's moving towards those targets, and the movement towards those targets is the creation of kamma. And it starts with the mental kamma. So the mind is the root, the mind is the forerunner, the mind is the source of all this, of all of our bodily and mental actions. And even though the mind has no physical attributes, it's the forerunner, it's the source of all of this. And so the mind is creating aims all the time, moving towards those aims. The move towards those aims is the creation of kamma. Now for the mind that's liberated, the mind that's liberated isn't creating those aims, and there isn't that movement towards an aim. And so there's no outflow towards a target, and the mind is said to stay within itself. But it's not that there's no movement or no action at all, and yet the action of the liberated mind doesn't create kamma. It's a profound point of Dhamma. So there's this thing, the principle, we talk about the principle of Dhamma, or the Laktam, the Dhamma principle, that the mind that's become Dhamma would act purely out of compassion and act according to Dhamma, act according to nature. So that's another aspect of Lompoa's teachings that he's bringing up, is that there's the mind and there's Dhamma, and Dhamma is nature. So Dhamma, you could think of Dhamma as the natural law or the natural order of things, the natural truth of the way things are. So we could think of Dhamma as just nature. And then the mind that is completely attuned to nature can then act in accordance with nature, completely in the flow with the natural order of things, and thus not create kamma. So of course there has to be this aim. There has to be that aim to end all aims, that aim to end kamma. So that would be the Noble Eightfold Path. That would be the kamma leading to the ending of kamma. So the Noble Eightfold Path. So it all comes back to the path, and we're not just going to be without targets, without aims, just from contemplating this, just from reflecting on it. But it is important to reflect on it in order to keep ourselves in line with the correct aim toward Dhamma, that Dhamma desire, Dhammachanda. So to keep ourselves in line with those aims, then we do need to recollect the goal, and this is Nibbana Nusati. And then Nibbana is just defined as coolness, peace. So we have these keywords that we can keep recollecting. The other kind of cool takeaway from Lungpa Liam was some of these one-liners he would come out with, which is desire is a burden. That desire is a burden. Yeah, it is. It is a burden. Why do we keep doing it? Why do we keep picking it up? Yeah, desire, when we have a desire, we're burdened by it. Or we could say a craving, maybe. But even in a way, the wholesome desires are also a burden. So even if we have the desire for Dhamma, in a way it's a burden. It's a burden that's leading us to the ending of burdens. So just, right. Desire is a burden. It's heavy. We keep picking it up. When we decide we want to do something, we decide we get worked up about something. So if we get worked up about something, this is very normal. It's a burden. It's a burden. Let's take anger as an example. So when somebody gets angry, just since when has it helped anybody? When somebody gets angry, everybody just wants that anger to go away. It's so unpleasant. So why do we do it? It's a mystery. It's very strange. And it causes harm. It's a burden. It creates a burden for us. It creates a burden for others. So it's just such a basic teaching. And it comes back to the Four Noble Truths. And we have, there is suffering, and there is the cause of suffering. So the Buddha says the cause of suffering is tanha, a craving. Kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, craving for any type of sensuality, craving to become, craving to not become. So those are the three types of craving. So just coming back to that, craving is a burden. That desire is a burden. It's heavy. And that's the cause of our suffering. That heaviness is the cause of suffering. Another thing that just struck me about Longpa Liem's visit is his absolute humility. So how rare is it for somebody to teach and not have that affect of being a teacher, of I am the teacher, I am teaching you. That is so rare. And just that example, that humbleness, that humility coming from Longpa Liem, which is very unusual, and the lack of conceit, the lack of holding himself in any way that would create any sort of sense of superiority or any comparison to anybody else, just to somebody who's completely comfortable within their own nature. And so I would see that as, I find this very moving when we see such a great Krupa Ajahn who is with such bright qualities, who is so humble. Oh, well, what does that say about me if I'm not humble in any given moment? What quality do I have which is better than that I can be conceited about? Well, of course, there is none. So because that not having conceit is the highest level, it's just everything is pointing to Dhamma. Everything is pointing to letting go. Everything is pointing to Nibbana, the liberation of the heart. So just to be reminded of these things, and this is why we ordain, this is why we come to the practice. Without Ajahn Chah, without Ajahn Liem, without these examples, then what's the point? We need these teachers, we need these examples to remind us of what's important so we can let go of our little nagging issues that we may have been giving too much importance to, come straight back to the recollections of Nibbana, coming back to the transcendent. Every day, every single day, we should be coming back to the transcendent at least a few times and reminding ourselves of that. Doesn't mean we let go of doing practical things. And Longpa Liem has that balance of being an incredibly practical person. And even we had him plant the lavender here. So he got really into lavender then. So we took him to a garden store in New Hampshire and he picked out some lavender, then planted some lavender at Temple Forest Monastery. And then at Tisarna, the same thing happened. We went to the local nursery and we got some lavender and a couple trees and then planted those at Tisarana. And then he got back to, after the long journey back to Thailand, after being back for less than 48 hours, he had like 25 lavender plants in Wat Bapong that he was looking after and had already arranged to be planted. And the reason being to look after to help promote the bees. The bees really like the lavender. He noticed that the bees like it. So he actually made this comment that, I'm not interested in plants. I'm interested in insects. So he said, that insects, Longpa, what do you mean you're interested in insects? It's the bees, because the bees pollinate. And then the more you can promote the bees, the honeybees, and if they can rely on the lavender, then they can actually, the local nature will be more complete and more replete. So just coming back to that, being incredibly observant, observing even things like how the insects, what types of flowers they prefer, and what their movements. The other thing that kind of struck me was just when he was here talking about giving rise to a sense of surrender, that he maybe at the age of 84 wasn't sure if he'd be able to make it out here to America. It's a very long journey from Thailand. And also just to travel around and be in the climate that's a little bit less familiar and maybe less what's going to be the best for his body. And thinking, oh, maybe he's not going to be able to make it. Maybe it's not good for his health. But then actually giving rise to a sense of surrender, which is just part of his character. Just to say, okay, well, maybe this would be better for my health to stay back, but it's going to be of benefit. It's going to be of benefit to go. So maybe letting go of that sense of one's own comfort to promote the comfort and the well-being of others, just such an ingrained part of his character that yes, of course he came. Of course he came to visit. But I found it very moving that, just somebody who talks like that in that sense of self-sacrifice, that sense of surrender, which is a big part of Ajahn Chah's teachings And it really is the practice. It's what we do. So I think we're very blessed to have somebody like Longpa Liem in our lives, and Lompa Jundi as well, just the very lovely presence of having him here. And I think it, for myself, it gives food for the heart for a long time to come. And of course, that was another hallmark of all of Longpa Liem's talks, food for the body, food for the heart. So looking at, we can understand what's going to be beneficial in terms of the practice if we understand physical food and we understand how, you know, how much focus we put on our health, on the health of the body, on having good food, having enough exercise and so on, having the right medicines that are going to work for us. And then looking at the health of the mind. So using how we look after our body in terms of our own health and then applying that to the health of the mind. So the health of the body, there may be doctors and medicines and the right foods, the wrong foods. We can get massage, acupuncture. We can do yoga and qigong. We can look after our body in various ways. And we put a lot of emphasis on this and focus on this. But then to promote the health of the mind and the heart, what is the food for the heart? And that's what we call the Dhamma Osota. The Dhamma Osota is the Dhamma medicine. Only the Dhamma medicine can cure the maladies of the heart. And what are the maladies of heart? The sadness, the sorrow, the anxiety, the suffering, the stress on the inside. That can only be cured by the Dhamma. And what is the Dhamma? The Dhamma of the Four Noble Truths. So by seeing it and acknowledging it, that sense of dissatisfaction in the heart, things maybe don't feel quite right. And that sense of the various cravings that the mind and the heart give rise to in order to try to relieve its own suffering. So there is that kind of acknowledgement, I need to relieve the suffering somehow, but then the focus is not quite correct. So there's the desire, we think our suffering is going to be relieved through the desire, through fulfilling the desire in various ways. But then the Buddha's pointing straight back to the heart, where the desire is an internal process that we're empowered to do something about it. We can actually do something about it. If the suffering was coming from outside, then we wouldn't be able to do anything about it. So how many times do we think the cause of suffering is the politicians, or the cause of my suffering is, you know, something happening outside, the weather? The cause of my suffering is illness coming from outside. The cause of my suffering is that person sitting next to me who's eating in a way that annoys me, you know, that the cause of my suffering is the pain that won't go away, the physical pain that won't go away. The Buddha is saying, no, none of those is actually the cause of the suffering. The cause of the suffering is the desire for it to be otherwise. So that's the cause of the suffering. That's what's causing the dissatisfaction. So that's the heaviness. And trying to change things on the outside, or even just to really bemoan the way things are on the outside, that's never ending. That's not going to end it. Somebody asked Ajahn Chah one time, why don't you get involved with politics? Why don't you focus on politics? And Ajahn Chah said, I'm interested in things that have an end. So let's look at something that has an end, that suffering does have an end. It does have an end. As we practice the long road of suffering, the end of that road is going to start to come into view. And somebody like Longpa Liem is really what it looks like. So those are just some reflections coming up. I'm still digesting this very poignant and very full visit from our great Krupa Ajahns, and we're very blessed to have them. So I think having shared some of those reflections, that seems appropriate for the time for Saturday night talk, and I'll just leave it there.